In the dead of night, when the moon is high and ill winds blow, and the banshees cry and the moonlight casts an unearthly glow, arise, my love, with tales of woe.
Good evening. It is 12 midnight, the Paranormal Hour. Welcome to Ghost. I'm your host, Chief Lawson. Ghost to Ghost is a podcast to discuss all paranormal and parapsychology subjects. You can find Ghost to Ghost on all major formats, so tell your friends, tell your family. Come listen to Ghost. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's once again that time for Ghost to Ghost. And tonight, I have as my co-host, Heather Lawson, case manager and podcast director.
Hello.
I have Mia Kerr, my social media and public relations manager.
Hey there.
And I have Eric Kerr, our research assistant.
Hello.
And just so everybody knows, Jennifer is on vacation. She sends her regards. We also have a special guest, which we'll be hearing from later in the show, Jack England. So tonight, our subject is University Heights Hospital. Now, this is a haunting that not everybody seems to know about. You know, a lot of people are very surprised, and they don't even know what the hospital was. And or even, you know, where it was located. So, a lot of tonight we're going to talk about is notes that I have and research that Eric has done. And then also we're going to talk a little bit about some of the different locations. And we're going to talk about some of the hot spots within the hospital. So, I tell you what, while we're here, Eric, why don't you share with us what you found out as far as research.
So, one of the things that I found very interesting was that everybody that had worked at University Heights wanted to talk, but they didn't necessarily want to talk about...
Nothing on the record, huh?
Nothing on the record. They were all talking amongst themselves, which is great. They reconnected, but it didn't really help us very much. But I found a lot of people had worked there, and a lot of people have a connection to the hospital.
Yes.
But it seems to be a very personal one that they don't want to share.
You know, and that's really unusual, because most people that work at a factory, a plant, a business that had some sort of camaraderie, they're willing to really tell stories, things that pop in their mind, good memories. And, you know, a hospital has, I'm sure, mixed good and bad. Anybody works in the medical, like I and Mia do, and Heather has, you know that comes from the program. But, you know, it's very odd. So go ahead and tell me what else you got.
Well, one thing I found that they definitely wanted to talk about was the morgue. The morgue was a very interesting thing in that it was attached via a tunnel.
Yes.
From the hospital. And it was a pretty long tunnel, and it went to the edge of the parking lot. So
yeah.
It was attached, yet not attached. And we'll be discussing some of that.
Yes. Tonight. Yeah, because I got some interesting things back and forth on the morgue. And on its location, too. Apparently, it changed locations at one point. So, at least what I'm told, anyway. And if you're listening and you know anything about University Heights and or someone that worked there, hey, reach out to us on Facebook. Mia's watching. If you post something, we'll know where it's at. So, okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, Eric.
Oh, it's fine. So, it was started in late 1961, and it was called Medico Environs Hospital. So it was originally built as a hybrid residential complex or hospital.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have all of the bells and whistles of a hospital, like an emergency room or operating room. But basically, it was an assisted living facility with an attached 50-bed hospital.
Mm-hmm.
It was licensed as a center to treat acute and chronic illnesses.
Yes.
But again, they didn't have actually operating room or major doctor's facilities at the time. Now, in 1963, the property was sold to a group that started University Heights Hospital. It was a nonprofit medical center, opened in November of 1963. And through the research, I was able to find that those were the first obituaries that mentioned University Heights Hospital.
Okay.
So, it operated in its present state until 1984. In August, they moved to the County Line Road site after Community South purchased them.
Mm-hmm.
The hospital was $26 million in debt.
And that, you know, if you think about that, That's a lot of money, even for a hospital.
For a hospital.
Yeah, I mean, you know, any business, you know, $1 to $2 million, and it's going to sound horrible, but a large enough business, that's a standard give me, you know, one to $2 million float. But $26 million, that didn't happen overnight. And, you know, it sounds like the people there may have been a little desperate, and they needed to do something, you know, and cut this deal.
Yeah, I definitely agree. They moved in August of 84, and when they did, the hospital sat for several years. There were a few plans, but there was no set plan to repurpose it. The first plan that was proposed, there was a group that wanted to open a facility for convicted criminals, a psychiatric facility.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and that didn't go very well with the neighbors.
Yeah, I bet. Quick side story, when Central State closed, the neighbors, people don't realize, neighbors have to live there. They buy property, and they're interested in what you're going to do because it could affect them. Nobody wants a wild, psychotic patient running loose and eating up in your backyard. And when they did that with Central State, they turned it over to IPD, at the time, Annapolis Police Department. They put their stables there. Well, the horses were great. They didn't make a lot of problems. Then the SWAT team moved in. And it seems like they like dropping flash and crack grenades at like 6 o'clock a.m. on a Sunday morning. It wasn't long. A petition was passed, and they wanted the SWAT team out of there. And, you know, they wanted them to go take their grenades and their explosives and their guns somewhere else. And they ended up getting
pumped. Bring back the horses.
Yeah, just leave the horses, but take SWAT as you go. And, oh, my God. So I can see that. I mean, you know, you're fighting for your property, the amount of your property, and you certainly don't want a psych ward in your backyard. That doesn't work well, you know.
So then, fast forward to 1988, which is, so the property sat abandoned in essence for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
1988, Indiana Bible College moved their campus to the previous site of the hospital, and the history seems to end right there.
Well, and I tell you, that sounds about right. And I noticed when we were researching this, you and I, on Facebook, I put the comment, it's a couple of people, oh, it's been tore down, there's apartments there. No, it isn't. Building's still there. When you look at the aerial,
Indiana Bible College might be upset that there was apartments there.
Yes, they might. Yes, yeah. they were very. I tell you what, I gotta admit, they were friendly people. But anytime you deal with a church, and I'm not picking on any religions, we don't. The problem you get into is most of them take a dim view of this. You know. Of course, I'm in a Masonic lodge, and most grandmasters, they know that we go out and investigate, and we don't really talk a lot about it because the PR is what it's all about. Everybody doesn't want bad PR. And if you have a ghost, it's like having cockroaches or bedbugs. You know, people get real freaky, and they don't want people to know. They don't want the neighbors to know. They don't want anybody around the house to know. So, you know, it gets to be kind of a problem. So when this place opened up, it began to, you know, I don't know if they, and the problem is, and I'll talk about this later, is whether or not they actually had any occurrences. Because the funny thing was, the maintenance man, when I talked to him, and I'll talk more about this later, he made a very good comment. He says, I never stay past 6 p.m. Classes end at 4. I'm out of here at 6. He said, I don't care what's going on. It can wait till morning. I'm out of here at 6. You know, only other time I remember this, when I was touring in Jamaica, I was touring the Rose Hall. And one of the tour guys go, oh, no, and he doesn't like it when we're here. He goes, we leave. You stay here? Yeah, that's on you. And I'll never forget that. But they go home before it goes dark. I get that. So who was the guy's name that came up as a security guard?
Mike Dance.
Okay, let me tell you a little bit about Mike. Mike and I were very, very good friends, and we still would be if I could get a hold of him. Mike and I worked together for years. Mike went from there to Capitol Police. He worked at Capitol Police for years. And anybody know what the Capitol Police is? It's a division of the Indiana State Police. And they guard all the historical sites. They guard the governor's mansion, the Capitol, all the downtown stuff. And their cars look just like state police cars, only says Capitol Police on it. They also now guard the state fairgrounds, I believe. But anyway, Mike worked for them. And he came to Ford Motors Plant Protection. I was on the Ford Fire Department. He came out looking to get on the security department there. And I and Mike worked together probably for, oh, God, probably it was more than 10 years. And Mike was a great guy. He's married to a wonderful lady named Carol, who had a wonderful sense of humor. Because to be married to him, you needed that, you know, as he would any fireman. And he kind of changed over into the firefighting end of it. We talked many times. And this is when this story came up. And at the time, he knew I was looking to write a book one day on paranormal activity and parapsychology. So he says, hey, let me tell you about the hospital. Well, as we went along, one side note is that, you know, he mentioned a guy named Jack England. I go, you know, it's funny. I'm related to a guy named Jack England. As we got talking, yeah, wouldn't you know it, same guy. So we reached out to him, and we later in the broadcast we'll have his interview. So, but let me tell you a little bit about what Mike told me. Now, these notes go back, clear back to 1998. So they get back in the back a little bit here. Originally, when the building was vacated, okay, and that was in 84 when they moved, okay, they and as you said, the building sat vacant, okay. So the guy that was the head of security, and I think he is passed too, there was no luck in relocating him, his name was Ted Powell. And he was the head of security, and they hired a company. Now, there's two different names that come up for this company. In my notes, it says Indianapolis Executive Security. When I talked to Jack, I think he remembered it as Executive Security, but I don't know the company's still in business. Now, if it's a company, I think it is. When I first came out of service, off my commission, I tried to apply at Executive Security. It was armed security outfit, and I actually, it was one of the few places that looked at me and said, you're overqualified. You'd be better off getting a job elsewhere. It'd pay better. Okay. And so, you know, that happened a couple of times, and it's weird. I never had anybody usually tell me I'm underqualified, not over. And so anyway, but they brought them in, okay? And this began a fiasco that lasted, my understanding was somewhere between like 90 days, and they couldn't keep guards. And the company was not a big company, but they supplied security to a lot of places. And I don't know where they all were. I remember the name somewhat, but it doesn't ring a great bell. But anyways, I and Jack were talking about this, and then later I and Mike, you know, this place was one of the upcoming good security firms. And the way that the way the hospital is laid out. And one of the things about the hospital is they have an old building and a new building. And I actually have a map that we'll put up for the visual part later on when we post this. The actual old building is shaped like a cross, okay? So it's a complete X shape, with the front door being at one of the ends of this X leg. And then there's a tunnel that's half submerged that goes over to the new building, okay? Now, the way that I understand it, and let me look at my notes here real quick here, my map. I didn't make notes off the map, but anyway, the map was hand-drawn by Mike Dance, and him and I were talking about this, so this is where these accounts come from. The main building had the X-ray in it and surgery. The old building had the morgue, originally the lobby and everything, and then the morgue came from a different building, and I'll explain that in a minute, which you were talking about where the tunnel went to the morgue. Mm-hmm. And so there may have been a couple of different stories to how where the morgue was at. But anyway, they had two outbuildings. One was maintenance. The other was actually the powerhouse. And both of those had, the maintenance building had a semi-submerged, if you want, submerged in the proper word, semi-sunken tunnel that went across. The powerhouse had a total tunnel that went across. And there's some stories with that. But anyway, as we go through these notes, one of the things that he told me was, he said that, you know, the thing is, he said, at the heart of each one of the crosses in the old building was a nurse's station. And that's where they work from. At the end of each leg was actually a staircase that went up and down between the floors, okay? In the center there was also elevators that could go up and down between the floors. Then you would go down toward the back of one of the legs. It would lead to a tunnel that went across to the new building, which was a very square building, you know, nothing fancy. Once again, it had elevators and it had a staircase set up. So anyway, one of the things they had problems with, he said, the first night, they actually staffed it real heavy. They had a guard on the first floor and third floor levels in the nurse's station. And the first floor, you had a desk by the door going out, and there was a separate room there. Now, the way this works, this is going back, and for me, being a nurse, this is going to have to step back some in the care days, but a separate room had all the call lights. It wasn't at a nurse's station where nowadays modern hospitals have those at, you know, each station hub. This was, and this covered the whole hospital. So every call light went back to this one area. It's also where the operator was at. You know, in those are days, I can remember those days as a kid, you know, because they page people over intercoms. You don't hear that now in a hospital. And right. They have beepers and everything else, and, you know, they would put messages out. You don't see that now. That's totally different. But anyway,
they still have pagers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've seen some of the radios that, you know, having been in the hospital a lot, not personally, but with other people in the hospital here lately, and I'm thinking, you know, that'd be the first thing falling in the toilet. But anyway, yeah, because it goes off way too much, I can tell you that. Anyway, as it goes along, you know, it's right there by the entrance. And So one of the first things that happened was these guys started telling stories of strange noises. They were quickly told, yeah, don't worry about it. It's an old building. It creaks. You'll be fine. And they had to go over, one of them had to go over to the new building and make rounds through it. And it was three floors as well, is my understanding. Then they had to walk out to the powerhouse. Now, the maintenance building, they only had to go out to if they had a problem. Okay, so that's one of the things that I thought was kind of odd. So anyway, over this period of time, Mike related this story to me. Now, Mike gave me all this in 1998. So just understand, this is all off my notes. One of the first things happened, now bear in mind, the building has been totally vacated. There's no patients. There's no food service. I mean, basically, it's a vacant building. So one of the first things that happened was is a plate appeared. Now, this is a tray, like a serving tray with plates on it, of food that was rotten in the cafeteria. He said, there's no way. Every plate, every tray, everything in the kitchen was gone. It was all transported to Community South, which, you know, we've been in Community South more than I care to remember. But anyway, you know, it all went there. And so then they started having noises from the kitchen. They said they heard pots and pans rattling, which was another impossibility because all the cookware was gone. And actually, even the dishwasher was disconnected. Most of the equipment was taken out of there. So my understanding was they didn't have stoves. They didn't have all that went to the new hospital. Nothing was there. So
they had a platter with rotten food?
Yeah. Now, I don't know what food. He never really told me. Yeah, but it was.
Could you smell the food?
Well, that's a good question. You know, that's something he never said, but make you wonder. I mean, you know, but yeah, it you know, had a couple plates on it, and it was like somebody eating part of a meal and left it. It's like been left for 3 months. He said there was flies on it, maggots on it. He said, and they called and said, someone was here eating a meal. And I remember Mike going, and he goes, well, the food was left in the cafeteria. He says, you guys need to learn to pick up your mess. And he says, it's not like that. You need to come down here. Now, Mike was the evening guard in charge at Community South. So anytime there was a problem, he had to drive to University Heights in one of the patrol vehicles to see what's going on. So he gets there, and he shows him the tray, and he says, honestly, he says, I didn't understand. I saw the tray, and then I get it. He says, I'm looking at this going, where the hell? The only thing I think of is, hey, when they move shit, they left this behind somehow or another, and somebody put it out. Don't worry about it. He told the guy, he says, you know, we'll get rid of it. And he says, I took it out and threw it in the dumpster. And he says, plate, bowls, and all. He says, hell with it. They can figure it out. And he says, so he just kind of blew it off. But they kept complaining about pot noises in the kitchen. So I'm banging around and whatnot. And then one night, one of the individuals that was in the old building saw a woman in the lobby of the new building while on patrol. And said she was standing there. And when he yelled out to her, she went around the corner. When he caught up, she wasn't there anymore, which started a complete, and like he said, anything happened, if they saw a mouse, they freaking called me, and I had to drive up there to find out what the hell was going on. And so he comes up, and there's a couple other two or three guards with him. They search the facility, don't find anyone. He looks at the guy and says, you're not drinking, right? And the guy says, no. So anyway, the next thing that happens is the store, at the end of the old building, all and in the new building, they had stairwells. The doors start opening to the stairwells, opening completely up, and then closing on their own. And he starts telling Mike about this. He says, I think you're hearing stuff. Don't worry about it. And then one of them said, I physically saw the door open and then close. So Mike goes down to the nearest marsh or wherever he was at the time, picks up a bunch of baby powder. And they go up and they baby powder the floor in the front of it and behind it. And he goes through great labors to make sure they can see. If this opens, they'll show the door track. And it will also show any footprints. Now, the one thing, like he said, was he figured out was the door didn't drag in because it was high enough. But the funny thing was, a couple places they didn't have any footprints, but you could physically see where he said there was like a trailing piece on the end of the door. It would make the arch in where it opened in the powder, but there was no you know, prints. And he said, normally I would worry about that, but I powdered the inside of the stairwell, so if you had to walk up and just push the panic button and leave it open, it would show. He said there was nothing. He says, suddenly I started thinking, maybe these guys aren't nearly as nuts as I thought they were. And you know, the funny thing was, the average lifespan of one of these guys patrolling the building was 2 nights. Most of them never lasted past 2 nights before they quit. An executive told them that they had to hire people, and they couldn't get people. Matter of fact, one guy hired in and left 4 hours into the shift and never would come back. Told him, keep the money. Ooh. He was out of there. And so, you know, they're going through people pretty quickly. Another thing that they talked about was the tunnel going to the powerhouse. Now, this was a totally underground tunnel. And what happened was, is when people would pass underneath there, when they got about halfway, somebody would shut down the lights. And it's kind of like a hallway parallel lighting system. There's a switch at either end that can operate the lights. But when they get in the middle, they'd shut them off. And he said this would cause the great run. You know, at that point, these individuals would pick one end to go to, and they run like hell. And he said they wouldn't go in without carrying a flashlight because of this. And, you know, this was a common practice at night. This thing was like waiting for somebody to arrive to go through the tunnel so they could shut the lights out. It got to be a big deal. So the next thing he told me about...
It was having fun.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I can see this as a kid. You always tell people, you know, when I die, after all this experience I've had, God help a few people. I have a list. And, I always told Ed, I said, I'm going to appear to you, and anytime you're making love, I'm going to be standing over you just waving a lot just so you know I'm there. Anyway, yeah, Ed's out there. If he's listening to that, I'm sure he's got a few choice words.
Those spirits have a sense of humor, don't they?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, you know, I caught a meme the other day where they're taking an EVP and one of them goes screaming to the mic. They really like it. And, yeah, so, you know, I could think of the things I would do when I return. So, you know, but anyway. So that was one of the big things. Yeah, and it got to the point they didn't want what they would do. Instead of going through the tunnel, they'd walk outside and lock the outside door of the powerhouse, come in and search it, and then go back to the main building without using the tunnel. It got to be that bad. And then one night, he got a call, and this guy was really shook up. He said he was pale white. He got there. He went over to the new building and was near the surgery suite and saw a surgeon come out. Now, this guy's covered in blood. And he's wearing an apron, which, you know, that doesn't happen nowadays. They have more aprons in years. But the apron's covered in blood. And he comes outside to the first wash basin to start washing off and taking his gloves off. And the guy, the guard, yelled to him and said, hey, what are you doing? The doctor turned to a surgeon, turned around, looked at him, and then just evaporated. At that point, he said he made it back to the building in somewhere under a minute and, you know, ran all the way, and that was from the third floor down. Yeah, I mean, that's incentive. So he gets back, and he tells this story to Mike, and they walk up to the surgery center. Of course, everything's gone. The lighting's gone. Everything's gone. But he swears up and down that's what he saw. So the guards started having a habit of turning the lights on instead of walking with a flashlight. They would turn the lights on to a corridor before they go down it. And again, the ghost would start playing with the lights, wait till they get down somewhere, and then flip the lights off. Or they would... you know, flip them off, and then as they start to walk back, flip a light to a room on. And this got to be so terrifying that finally, at some point, they said, you know, we don't know what we're going to do. Then there was the incident of the prowler in the maintenance building. They would see from where they sat an individual walking around the maintenance building, and they'd freak out a little bit, and they'd send a guard out there. And of course, Mike would get called up, and they couldn't find him. The building was locked, nobody in it, nobody outside of it, couldn't see anything. And as far as I know, they never had cameras. I you know, they didn't have anything of that nature. Then they had the biggest one, I think it scared the most, was the call light issue. They would have in the middle of the night, like 1 o'clock in the morning, a call light would come on, like second floor in one of the rooms. And the guy on the first floor would see it, and they'd have to go up and check this out. And they get to the room, nothing there, but the call light was pulled. And they'd reset the call light, and by the time they could get down to the first floor and sit down at the desk outside that room, another call light would go. And they started having this a lot. And, of course, the windows were, at that time, Mike told me the windows were barred and caged. They did that after, you know, they put chain link fence and stuff over them after they vacated the building, keep people out. He said, there's no way somebody could have gotten that building. He said, but yet, you know, they were pulling these lights. So, anyway.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. That's a little scary. I mean, you're sitting there and you know there's nobody in the building but you and the light comes on. So, one
nobody
of the...
Nobody but you and the ghost.
Yeah, you and the ghost. And, you know, I think I'd look at him and go, look, you need to turn that off. I don't want to go up them stairs again. And why the stairs were important was the elevator, they actually turned off. And the reason they turned it off, they didn't do it right away, but the elevator would take notions. Now, most elevators are programmed to home floor. There's some floor that the elevator, after a certain amount of no activity, will return to that position. And generally, it's a first floor. That's what they usually have them programmed as. This elevator would go up to some place, open, and then come back and open on the main floor.
Oh.
And it would do it throughout the night. Elevators are supposed to stay shut and idle until someone pushes a button. But it happened so much it scared
somebody
the guards.
Somebody was pushing a button.
Yeah, somebody was riding the elevators. So at one point when Jack took over, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes with Jack, but they actually shut the elevators off because it was causing more problem than it was anything else. So all the guards had to use the stairs while they're guarding the building.
Maybe it was guardian angels having the doors open so you could get out quickly.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I tell you what, if they opened, I'd certainly think about getting out quickly.
Well, at least they were fit guards.
Yes. Well, they were. Yeah, Jack was always a thin son of a gun. Ever since yes. I knew him, he's the kind of guy who could eat six courses in a meal and never gain any weight.
Tunnels.
So, yeah.
Running the tunnels.
Now, Mike was a big guy, but you know, when properly motivated, he could make distance. I watched him do it a couple of times. But you know, one of the weirdest stories, I guess, one of the best stories ever told to me was about Dr. Green. One night there was this horrible thunderstorm, and the guards were on duty, and one by the main door in the old building, a car pulls up. Now, nobody seems to remember the description, but it was an older model car. And now, bear in mind, this is in the 80s, so older model car could be in the 70s, could be the 60s. You know, they still had a lot of 60s out there. He gets out, walks up the door. He's in a raincoat, an overcoat, and a leather doctor's bag, the old-fashioned black leather. And he tells this guard that he needs in because there's a patient of his there. He's Dr. Green. He's there to see the patient. Well, the guard quickly informs him that all the patients have been moved to the county line facility and needs to go up there. And he says, no, my patient's still here. And he says, I need to see him. He says, okay, well, I'll tell you what. Step in, stand right there. I'll go call Community South, see if he's there. And I'll call security because we have no one here. When he goes to call the phone, he gets a hold of Mike on the phone. And he turns around and the doctor in the car is gone. And he hangs the phone up on Mike. Wow. And Mike said, you know, if I get an automatic hang-up, that means, yeah, damn it, I got to drive up there. And so he drives up, and this guard relates his story to him. And it's pouring the rain. And it's a horrible thunderstorm. And he says, Mike does a little research. Turns out Dr. Green was a participating doctor. He'd passed at the time. But he was a doctor there that had visitation rights there and was seeing patients there. And wow. Now the patient name never came out, so Mike couldn't trace it, but he did find, actually, there's a plaque for Dr. Green, if it's the same doctor. We've seen this in Community South, and there's a dedication plaque to him, and he actually came from University Heights. There's, you know, and I think Community covered some of that, too. You know, I don't know.
Maybe his patient really was still there.
Yeah, yeah. Makes you wonder, wouldn't it? Maybe his patient was still Probably. There, and he was coming to see him. I mean, the funny thing that makes me wonder is, you know, we were talking about the fact, and Eric pointed this out, that, you know, they don't want to talk about it. There's not a lot of record of it. Everywhere you look, you know, usually you find a lot of stuff, but there really isn't. So I'm wondering, you know, and of course this is a conspiracy theory. I mean, I'm not making any allegations. I want to point that out because we don't want to be sued. But anyway, yeah, I just kind of wonder if there isn't a reason for that. You know, one thing I learned in intelligence is if something happens, there's generally a reason for it. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, what don't we know that we can't get to that come out of this, you know?
I find it very interesting that people want to sweep this under the rug. Nobody yeah. wants to talk about it. But when I was doing research, there wasn't any type of extreme event or anything that would explain things that are yeah. happening there.
Just except for the amount of money they were in arrears. And I mean, you know, that's the odd part. But, you know, money's a funny thing. And you know, a lot of people, Brad Meltzer once said, you know, if you want to get to the truth, follow the money. And that's the point, you know.
Very true.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's a possibility. So, okay. Well, having elated those stories from Mike Dance, now, again, I took this interview back in actually August of 98. So, we're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to have Jack England on the line. He's going to tell us his experiences. Now, I want to lead into this a little bit. At one point, Executive Indianapolis Security called and said, we're done. We can't keep people. It's not worth the money. We're out of there. So they leave the building, and so they got to do something. So Ted and Mike put their heads together and decide, hey, we're going to hire some people, and they're going to be employees of security, and they'll eventually come up to community. Mike was one of these people, or I'm sorry, Jack was one of these people who was hired. So Jack had came out, and I don't remember where he was working at before. I think he was working at a sewer plant as a security, but he gets hired in. And he had some wonderful stories, including his wife, Leanne, and some of the things that happened there, which I find very fascinating. I think you will, too. So we're going to take a break, and then we come back. We'll be there for the interview for Jack England, and we'll see what he's got to say. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chief Lawson from Spirit Paranormal Indiana and from the podcast Ghost to Ghost. I'd like to make a special announcement. On April the 7th, at the Murat Theater of Old National Center, Dustin Perry of Taps fame will be making a one-night-only appearance. Come spend the night with Dustin as he recounts some of his previous cases and investigation techniques. Spirit Indiana will also be there to assist Dustin in any way we can. And please watch our Facebook page as we are working out a special price for tickets that will be announced on our Facebook page. And by using that, you will get a special discount on the tickets you purchase. Again, this is April the 7th. Please pass the word. Come out and spend a night. Listen to Dustin Perry. You won't regret it. Again, this is Chief Lawson, and thank you so much for listening to Ghost to Ghost. All right, folks, we are now here with Jack England, and this is our interview. Hope you enjoy it. We're with Jack England, a good personal friend of mine and my relation. And, Jack, you worked at the University Heights Hospital after it had moved to Community East. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Do you remember what year that is, possibly?
Yes, it was January of 1986 when I started.
Okay. And when you started, everything was already moved. All the patients were up at South and all that, and you were working for the hospital, though, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about what your duties were during the day. Worked during the day or during the night?
No, it was third shift.
Okay. So what were your duties then?
Just basically patrol the building, you know, make sure there hadn't been any obvious break-ins. Just try to deter anyone or anything that we came across and just have a presence there overnight so that hopefully no one would try to get into the facility.
Was this a uniformed or armed position?
Uniformed, yes. Armed, no.
Yeah, just asking. I was curious.
However, that didn't stop me from taking my 16-gauge with me occasionally.
I don't blame you there. There's just certain things you don't take chances on. Did you have a lot of problems with human vagrants and things that, you know, go on in the area?
Not that I found. Pretty much, the building was pretty well secured.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have any issues as far as vagrants that we knew of.
Okay. Well, and you know, as you know, I was talking some time ago, and why I said this, I went over my notes. My notes date back to 1998, so they're not recent, needless to say. And I was looking, just to kind of get the layout of the building, I was looking at the building and the picture of the building, and when I looked at it, the main building looks like it's kind of in the shape of roughly a cross. Is that kind of right, like an X?
Yeah. Of course, kinda. I never saw it from just sitting there where I was in the main lobby area. You know, one hall would go south, one hall would go north, and then another one would kind of go west, veering off to the newer addition.
Okay, and then there was a newer area. And as I told you before, I talked with Mike Dance many, many years ago, and I've lost track of Mike. And he drew me a map, and we both know now that neither one of us had careers in cryptology or in the Heron School of Art. But anyway, it has the old building going to the new building. The new building had, he said, surgery, x-ray, or no, I'm sorry. The new building had surgery and x-ray in it. Is that correct?
Yeah, it had a laboratory as well.
Yeah. And then it had the old building had the morgue in it and all that. And then there was a maintenance building or powerhouse that had a tunnel going to it, right?
Correct.
Okay. So I'm just kind of getting a lay of the land, if you will. Okay. And you know, how long did you work there? Do you remember?
Well, I worked for University of Heights, which became Community Hospital South, for 10 years. But as far as in the old University of Heights building, I was there for probably 4 months.
Okay. And you know, that's where you start out. Do you know, this name came up in my notes, and I'm not going to ask you any question and to surprise you. This came up. Do you know a guy named Jim Delaney? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that was our supervisor.
Okay. Well, the problem is my handwriting, after I've written anything, and time has elapsed of, let's say, 45 minutes, it looks like Egyptian hieroglyphs, and I have to sit and figure out. I can make out Jim Delaney, but I couldn't make out, you know, again, these notes were made in 1998. So, you know, I'm looking at it going, I wonder who the hell that was, because it doesn't ring any memories. I've slept since then, and my wife is still laughing. Yeah.
The full name was James P. Delaney.
Okay. So he was the head of security at Community then?
Yeah.
Okay. And so you worked for him. And then what role did Mike Dance play in this? Do you remember?
Mike Dance worked for the hospital as well, but he was second shift at the new building.
Okay. Okay. Now, as I understand it, and I talked to him, and I'm not going over that stuff right now, but let's start with day one. You come in to the building, and you're hired, and you're there for your very first day on your own. Was there anybody else in the building besides you?
I trained with a guy named Ted. I forget his last name, but he's like a 6.5, 7 foot tall old guy. I trained with him for a few days, and then I was cut loose on my.
Somewhere I saw that name in the notes, Ted. I didn't see a last name. I saw Ted. So, okay, so he hired... No, I'll tell you what. That was notes I think I made when I talked to you. So, anyway, okay, so you trained with him. Did he tell you that he'd experienced anything odd in the building and he paranormal?
No, he wouldn't talk about anything.
Okay, just wondered. So, okay, so the first night you're on your own, was there anything that very first night that happened?
No, nothing really. Actually, for the first several nights, everything seemed to be okay.
So, after the first several nights, you started, you know, everything went good. You thought, easy peasy job, no big deal.
Lulled you into a sense of security.
Yeah. Right. Or baited you, one or the other. It depends on how you want to look at that. So, I'll tell you. That's creepy in some ways. Okay, so the first night you had... Now, did anybody else tell you about anything weird going on?
No, I don't think they wanted me to know because I was going to be there by myself.
Yeah?
Of course not.
No, that's a bad idea. Let the new guy know the building's haunted. It's better to let him find out on his own. That's always a good way.
Right.
Okay, so the first night that you... Tell me about the first thing you you experienced while you were there at the building.
Probably just different noises, doors opening and closing.
And again, at this point, you're by yourself, right?
Yeah, every night I was by myself. Just the door, you know, noise of the doors opening and closing.
Wow. Okay, now, I was told, I think it was by Mike, but I was told that patient lights would come on in rooms. Did you have any of that happen the first night?
No, thank heavens.
Yeah, that's rough. Yeah. I'll be honest with you, I've done parapsychology for over 30 years, and I don't know, that would creep me out enough that I'd need someone there with me, I think, to go down and look at that. I don't blame you. So what was the very first thing? So the noises and the door slamming and so forth was your first thing. What else did you notice to happen?
Well, that probably went on for a while until I really started getting spooked. And then just gradually, just the amount of times it would happen would increase.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of one night, for some reason, all of the fire doors just slammed at the exact time.
Oh, yeah. I can see why they had problems keeping people. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't do that.
Yeah, and that's on every floor, right?
Well, it sounded like every floor. Certainly every floor.
Well, yeah, at that point, you don't necessarily want to go see. I mean, I get that.
It's not like they liked you.
And just let me say that I did go see, and it was pretty much every fire door.
Now, this is primarily in the old building, or the old building and the new building?
Primarily in the old building.
Okay. Now, go ahead I'm going to let you at this point just go ahead and tell me the things you saw and the things that have happened.
Okay, sure. Well, I think one time, last time we spoke, actually.
Yes.
I told you about the dreaded corridor leading to the maintenance building.
Yeah, now the maintenance building, that was above ground or was that below ground?
That was above ground.
Okay.
But the tunnel leading to it was kind of half underground and half above.
I remember, yes.
Then the above section was pretty much all glass.
Yes.
All the way around. And I would really get the creepy feeling every time I walked through there. Never experienced anything. Just had a creepy feeling that maybe I was being watched.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Didn't you tell me something about the windows in the tunnel?
I don't recall other than saying I didn't like the windows. I always felt like someone was watching me through the windows.
Yeah, it's a little creepy. Now, what time did you get off at night?
I got off at 7 a.m.
Oh, boy.
Went in, worked 11 p.m. to 7 a.m.
Once upon a time, I was a supervisor for 8 Ambulance. I worked a 7 to 7 shift. That was a great shift. I absolutely appalled it. But anyway, I get that. Tell me what else happened to you while you were there.
Okay, well, fortunately for us, in the main lobby area of the old building was a desk and a chair. The chair kind of faced the main entrance, and then there was a TV mounted on the ceiling, something like you would see in a waiting room where people could watch.
Sure.
And I think that's what it was. But they left cable on to kind of give us something to do at night to hopefully keep us awake.
Yeah.
But one night I was sitting there watching TV, and, you know, you get kind of tired, your head kind of, you know, starts to doze or bob, as I would say.
Yes.
Well, the very first time my head went to bob, I caught myself, and I tried to raise my head up, and I couldn't raise my head up. And wow. I couldn't move, I couldn't raise my head up. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong. So I opened my eyes, and I couldn't see anything, but I kind of looked out the top of my eyes since my head was down.
Yes.
And I saw standing against the wall two legs and dark dress pants with black shoes. And wow. I couldn't see above the face. I could just see the legs and the feet.
Yes.
Wow. And no matter how hard I tried, I could not move, could not raise my head.
Yeah.
And then, just casually, kind of just the legs and the feet kind of stepped back into the wall.
Oh.
Sounds freaky. Once they went completely into the wall, I was instantly free. I could move, raise my head, do whatever.
The area went in the wall. Do you know what area that was? Was that another room or a stairway or...
No, it was right there in what would have been the main entrance lobby.
Okay, so right there where your desk sat near the front door where the entrance was at, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Correct. So, well, that's, you know, that's kind of like a half of a shadow figure. That's a little eerie. Now,
not fun.
Something I wanted to ask you, because I know, and again, I have not talked to Mike since 1998, so I've, you know, as I was going through my notes, what I could read of them, you know, one thing came up that they hired a security service apparently before they hired you guys to try to watch that, and it didn't work out. Do you know anything about that, or did you hear anything about that?
I just know that they couldn't keep security people.
Yes.
That's why they felt if they had someone on their actual hospital payroll would be a little better job, and they'd be able to keep people.
Sure. Well, you know, was there anything else besides those items that you saw or may have witnessed? I know we talked about a couple of them that night.
Sure. One time, you know, I got to the point where I was just, you know, really felt uncomfortable by myself. So I would get my wife to, like, take me and drop me off and hang out for a little while.
And what's your wife's name, Jack?
Her name's Leanne.
Yep. And we're friends as well. I, Jack, and Leanne, you could honestly say we about grew up together. We worked together. To the time that, you know, I went to college and then went in the service, and everybody kind of split and went their own way. So tell me what happened then.
Okay. Well, of course, she wasn't my wife at the time. She's just my girlfriend.
Yeah.
But we were making initial rounds in the building, and we were on, I think it was the third floor, probably the west wing, if I remember correctly. And we're just, you know, we just stepped down the hall, and all of a sudden, from the hallway, we heard somebody cough.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we just stopped and looked at each other, and I told her, I'm like, stay here, and if I yell, you just run.
Good advice.
Yeah, don't look back. Yeah. I'll catch up with you when we get to the door. I get
if
you.
If I'm able.
Well, now, what was the third floor? What normally was, I mean, when the hospital was in operation, was that just a patient floor, or did they have anything like surgery or labs or anything on that floor?
No, it was patient floor.
Okay, so it was a patient floor. So, well, you know, that is pretty interesting. That is, she heard it as well. You both heard the cough.
Oh, yeah, definitely she heard it. And of course, I went back and looked, and I checked everywhere. I thought I could see anyone. You know, even in the cubby holes, you know, the little closet where people hang their clothes.
Sure.
I just could not find anybody.
Wow. Wow. Now, what other things did you have happen while you were there?
Well, of course, I think we talked about there was, at the end of the stairwell, one stairwell, they had so many problems with doors opening and closing.
Yes.
That someone lined the entire staircase with powder.
Yeah, talcum powder. Yeah, old school. Right, old school ghost hunting. Yeah,
right on, right on. So they could see if anybody was actually walking down the halls or whatever.
Sure.
However, during my time, you know, people had gone up and down so much that I couldn't tell anything.
I'll tell you, it's great when it works. But many, many years ago, probably 10 or 15 years ago, we had a tech manager, and I'm not going to mention his name because, you know, I love him dearly, but he retired a long time ago, and he was with us, and I'll never forget, we were on a investigation, and I powdered an area as I walked, and I looked behind me to find my tech manager standing there, and I looked at him, I said, have you been here long? And he looks at me and goes, yeah, about 5 minutes. He says, why, you been dropping all this powder? I said, did you just walk through all that? He goes, well, yeah. I looked at him, I said, did you miss the briefing on what we were doing? He says, yeah, I guess. You know, it's that.
Sounds like something.
Yeah, I didn't choke him, but I mean, it was, the thought was there, and we had to go repowder it. But I mean, yeah, I mean, it's old school, but it does work. I mean, seriously, if you want to track footprints, a door opening, closing a compartment, if you can, you know, if it rubs the floor, that's a great way to do. The bad thing is, if you're in a client's home, you have to be able to clean all that up before you leave. You know, that's the that's the bad downside. But, you know, we're in a lot of abandoned buildings at times and things like that. And, yeah, it doesn't matter so much. So, okay, so what other things did you run into?
Well, I ran into the fact that we always had to use the stairs because the elevators were shut off.
Hmm. I remember that. Tell me about that.
Yeah. You know, I asked, you know, why, you know, all the power's on, why can't we use the elevators?
Mm-hmm.
And old Tim, kind of creepy himself, he just said, well, they had to shut the elevators off because they would go to different floors, come back and open up, and there wouldn't be anybody in them.
Yeah, that wouldn't help matters when you're staying there all night.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, every time. Well, I tell you, I mean, you know, elevators to me are creepy. How about you, Heather? You like those?
They're okay.
I've never, when I was in fire training.
I know you don't especially like the ones with glass.
No, I don't like glass elevator. I don't want to see where we're going, personally. You know, once you've been on a rescue crew or rope training for, you know, high angle rescue or elevator shafts, yeah, that breaks you, that whole thing. Personally, I love escalators, but, you know, not much on elevators. It goes above 5 or 6 floors or it's glass. There was one in Vegas I went on, and you could see all the way up. And I don't care how much you drank, it didn't help. And I was ready when that door opened. I think I mowed 3 people over getting off the elevator because, I, you know, anything went wrong, I didn't want to be there when it fell. I don't know why. Right, you know, I've had Otis elevator people that trained us go, it won't fall. There's no way it can fall. You know, it can't. And so, anyway, but
I got to tell you the story about my first dead body.
Oh yeah, I think Mike may have told me this story, but go ahead. Yeah, I'd love to hear your side of it.
So, part of our job at the new hospital was, mm-hmm. well, luckily it was at the old hospital, but we would be called to take the bodies down to the morgue.
Sure.
So, you know, when they interviewed me, they're like, are you scared of dead bodies? I'm like, no, won't bother me at all. Well, I went to, my first body is like, oh no. So I shoved it in the elevator and I pushed the first floor button, ran down the stairs, get down. The elevator never comes down.
Oh, God, this is not the story I heard, but go ahead. This is getting good. So we had a body on the elevator moving on its own.
Yeah, so I run upstairs, right?
Yeah.
And the elevator's there, the door's open, and my body was standing out in kind of like the foyer area.
Oh, God. So did somebody wheel him out then?
He was standing?
Huh?
The body was standing?
No, I think he meant... No, it was... He wheeled... Somebody wheeled him out in the foyer.
Okay.
Which is bad.
Yeah. I died of a heart attack myself.
Yeah.
But, so I get the body and I put it back in the elevator.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, okay, let me think this through. If I put it in feet first and I stand up toward the front of the elevator, mm-hmm. if the body sits on me, it's going to sit up away from me.
Yeah.
And then hopefully I can get out of the elevator. So for the longest time, I'd always put bodies in feet first in the elevator.
Well, you know, of course, we're always taught to move patients head first. But now the story I was told, now I'll tell you about this because we always cut this out of broadcast. But the story I was told by Mike, okay, you can tell me if it's true or not. Apparently, you guys had moved a body together that had not breathed its last breath. Does that ring any bells? Okay. That was a story I heard about.
And when we moved it, the breath came out.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if I ran or jumped or what.
He said you passed him and that you were in a narrow corridor, but you still passed him over top of the body when it went off. So I don't know. I mean, it'd been exaggerated, you know, but...
I've forgotten all about that. Thank you.
Well, no, that you know, as we talk, things come back to my mind. Me and Mike worked together for many, many years. I thought the absolute world of him. He had a wonderful personality and a terrible temper at times, but he worked for me. He did a great job. He had that Benny Hill. He could do Benny Hill to no end. And probably the worst thing I ever had with him was whenever he would leave, when we had out at Ford, we had a dispatch, you had one security personnel and one fire personnel. And when Mike relieved the fire personnel, you had to watch him. Because if you get on the intercom, it was like Saturday Night Live. He would imitate, he did Forrest Gump. He would do all, and it's like, Jesus Christ, I get reports on this. People pissed, go, I don't know who that is on the intercom, but we can't, you know, can't be playing around on there. And oh my God, you know. But he was a hoot. I got to admit, I miss him. I haven't seen him in a long time. Ron Nichols reached out to me, who was another paramedic firefighter. I hadn't talked to him in a while. The guy that we all worked for died, and none of us knew about it. And Ron reached out to me. He could find me through the Brotherhood. He's a Black Mason. And so he reached out and said, hey, did you know this? And then I asked him about Mike, and he hooked me up. Actually, all things, Mike goes, I called him on the phone, and his number's not the same anymore. And I called him. I said, hey, dude, I'd love to talk to you a little bit. How's Carol doing, his wife? And we got there, and I swear to God to you, he looked like Jesus. He grew this hair that went down. I mean, I looked at him because Mike was always clean cut, sidewalls. I mean, you know, got that very Benny Hill thing. My God, he had this long hair. And I go, what happened? I go, I feel like singing Hare Krishna. What happened to you, dude? Yeah, look at that. He goes, oh, I got retired. I just didn't want to get it cut. And I go, why is it everybody retires gets cheap? I mean, oh, my God. But, yeah, he told me that story about the body, and we won't go terribly detailed, but we've all had that experience. I mean, I didn't transport a whole lot in the fire department. Most people we transported. Same thing with Warren. At Ford, we transported to a certain period of time, and then we retired our ambulance and used Warren as transport, but we allowed Warren to use our training facilities. We got so much better training than they did. And I actually was asked to go up and teach. I taught at Eastern Michigan University and MSU, both for about 3 months, because they needed extra instructors. I was teaching at IUPUI and Ivy Tech, so they asked me to come down and teach fire science there. So the guys on Warren used us all the time. We'd bring them in, and you know, we always laugh because when their fire engine, if they had a fire engine that went out of service, they had to beg the trustee and the mayor to get another fire engine. When our fire engine went out, I called Red up in Detroit and said, hey, you know, the fire engine bit the dust. We need another one. And they would order another one at Seagate. And we would fly to Philadelphia to pick it up. It was great. We'd fly out. They would put us up to Carlton Ritz. We'd get suites. And my God, we drove it back. It was like a road trip. And, you know, being chief, I got to choose who went. And, of course, me was always going to be the one that went. And someone else. But usually me and Mike go back and get it. And pick it up and bring it in. But, yeah, it is so much difference. And but he told me this story. And, I taught a EMT class for years as a primary instructor. And I always joked and said I came up from same as you, from the beginning, back in the early days, and I always, in my class graduated, I always played Mother Jugs and Speed, which was a TV show, had Bill Cosby and Raquel Welch on it, and I always do that for the graduating class, because that's the way it used to be back in the old days. So, anyway, all right, so let's get back onto this. Is there anything else you remember from the building, perchance? That, I know we talked a little bit that night.
Not from the building particularly. There's some stories I think that you may recall, you may cover later yourself.
Okay.
About Dr. Green.
Yeah, well, go ahead and recant them. Anything that you remember, go ahead and put out there for us.
Better than I did. I knew basics, but you knew a little bit more than what I did.
Well, Mike told me that when they had, and I believe the company was called Executive Security. Now, we're talking about, I was told this in 98, so in what time, what year did you start again?
96, and you're correct, it was Executive Security.
Okay, I thought that sounded right, and they brought them in, and the three stories I heard from Mike, I got in my notes. There are probably more in here if I can decipher them at some point. I'll have to send these over to my wife and Jennifer and let them see if they can get anything out of them. But one thing that he told me, I remember distinctly, was that one of the guards they had come in, there was this really rainy night. It was a horrible rainy night, and it was the entryway to the old building, which, as I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's where your desk and TV and everything was at. And
correct.
The car rolled up, and there was not a lot of information about the car. No one really described it. It was an old car, new car, whatever. It was a dark color car, that we knew. And this gentleman came to the door. He had an old-style doctor's bag. Now, the one that comes to my mind's eye is this leather satchel that he has in his hand. And he's standing there, and he tells the guard, he says, "Hey, I'm here to see patient such and such. My name is Dr. Green, and I am, you know, he's here." And the guard says, "I'm sorry, doctor, I think you have this mixed up. You know, unfortunately, you know, all the patients have been moved to the new building, which is Community South. It's up off County Line Road. I mean, there's no one here but just me. There's no one else in the building." And I think at the time, I may be wrong, and you can correct me if you know different. At the time, they actually put three guards. They put one on each floor of the old building, and they had three guards there at one time. They couldn't even keep them. And that's as I remember, and I could be incorrect on that fact. But anyway, you know, this is reaching back. You know, this is pretty good. That's 25, 26 years ago. So, I mean, I'm going this by memory and what I can decipher. Anyway, the doctor says, "Look, I'm telling you, the patient is here." And at that point, he says, "Well, I'll tell you what. Let me walk back and call the hospital at my desk," and he says, "and see if that patient is there." When he calls the hospital, they said, "No, you know, there's no, you don't have any patients, and no, we don't have that patient, but that doctor is, he's valid. That is a actual doctor practiced here," he said, 15 years ago. "The man, I think, is dead." And when the guard turned back to see where the car was and everything, it was gone. The doctor was gone, the bag was gone, the car was gone. It was all gone. Couple other things that he brought up that I still have in my notes is that the operational suite, which I believe this was in the new building, correct?
I believe so.
Okay, was this on the second or third floor? Do you remember? And it's okay if you don't.
I don't really recall.
Okay, so I can't decipher my notes. It says something floor, but I can't make out what it says. So it's on one of the floors. We got three to choose from. Yeah. So
it may have been. I think it was the second floor.
Okay, and it looked like a 2. I was going with that. It was either a 2 or it could have been a Cupid's arrow. I'm not sure. Anyway, but at that point in time, as I understand it, they were patrolling on that floor, and as they approached the surgery suite, a doctor came out. Now, the doctor was in scrubs, you know, mask on the face, you know, a skull cap, and he had an apron on. It was all covered in blood, and he came out and started washing his hands. Well, I'll tell you one thing. Even in 98, very rare surgeons had aprons on. That was a very old practice. They generally just wore, yeah, they wore scrubs and pretty much just.
I bet he had a cloth mask.
Yeah, definitely reusable.
They looked close enough.
Yeah, and I mean, when you were an MA, what did they still didn't have aprons?
Oh,
right?
No,
we're talking something from the 40s or earlier. So anyway,
I mean, I went through MA school in 2009.
Yeah.
Yeah, right before Ashley was born.
Well, I know everybody looks at me when I say something about nurses used to be dressed in white and had these funny little caps. Everybody looks at me like, "Really? You're that old?" Yeah. Anyway, Always look at them and go, you ever see secondhand lions? You should think about that. Anyway, but yeah, long story short, apparently the figure disappeared after it was washing its hands. And then the issue came up, and we talked about the talc powder that was laid down. Apparently they had said that when they were walking up on the hallway where they had the cross section there, they could actually visually see the stair door open and close. Now, I don't know, all the stair doors that I'm aware of to meet fire code open inward. And there's a reason for that. But anyway, they don't open outward. So I don't know how they saw this. I'm just giving you what they told me. But anyway, Mike came in and came up with the idea of getting talcum powder to spray. He went to the Rexall Drugs or where it was around there close by and got about three or four of these things, these talcum powder. And they laid it down trying to figure out if there was someone walking or someone. And then the other thing that they were very prominent about, two things, was one was they had an issue with all the patient lights coming on. That, you know, and I guess, now correct me if I'm wrong, Jack, because you were there and I wasn't. They said at the crossroads of these in the old building that there was a panel there that monitored all the patient lights. Was that there when you were there?
I'm trying to remember.
That's okay. You know, my mind works like a carousel these days. I have to wait for the right horse. And I,
you know,
it's been a little bit.
Because it was back in, there was a little area off to the side where the switchboard operator was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there were lights in there for the doctors. I don't know about the patients, though.
Well, I know, you know, if it's like any of the other hospitals, and it's not something one told me, but all the old hospitals had lights on the ceiling. This is back before the days of beepers, cell phones, all that. And if there was a doctor on call, a certain light would blink, and they had like green lights for doctors, red for nurses, something for specialists, but they would blink it, and then if they didn't answer, they would text you, they would call you over the PA system.
They'd start paging.
Yeah, doctor, you know, I think everybody that became a firefighter like myself at my age, I know you probably remember this, is the movie or the TV show Emergency 51. And I got all the seasons recorded, and I look back on that and I go, holy cow. But that's how hospitals ran back then. And so, anyway, I was told that these patient lights would come on. The guard would walk down to that room, and, of course, the room is empty. There's nothing there. There was another account of a couple of patient food trays that they found near the cafeteria preparation, which I think was in the old building, as I recall, from what I was told. And it had food on it that had rotted.
Yeah, I was in the basement of the old building.
Yeah, and you know, the food had rotten on the trays. Like, it had been prepared, no one had eaten it. And all the trays and everything were gone except for, obviously, these. And these were metal trays, and I was told the trays they were using was a latex polymer, and they got rid of metal trays back in the 50s. But yet, they had these trays. So, you know, it's one of those odd things that come up. And I guess it got to the point they couldn't keep guards, and executive security called and said, hey, I'm sorry, we're pulling our people out. We're not interested. We can't, you know, nobody wants to come back. But those were the stories that I, oh, there was one more. And that was the,
you can't pay us enough.
Yeah, you can't pay us enough. Yeah. There was one story about the tunnel that led to the powerhouse. I'm sorry, go ahead. Okay. Go ahead, Jack.
No, I just said, yeah, executive security said, yeah, just hire Jack.
Yeah, that's it. Just hire Jack. He'll handle this. We got this taken care of. Yeah, well, my understanding was is that, and some of the nurses talked about this, back when the hospital was in operation, because I talked to a few of them. I actually taught for community hospital. It was before it became community hospital. And I actually do serve on a board for Brian Mills currently of Community Hospitals Incorporated, a patient advocate board. But anyway, at the time, you know, we were in the business building, nurses education, and there was a lot of nurses told me, yeah, you know, when you would have to go to the powerhouse for some reason. I'm going, why is a nurse going to the powerhouse? But anyway, they would go to the powerhouse, they had to go across this tunnel, and wait till you got halfway through the tunnel, and this entity would turn the lights off. So they would have two people go, and one person would stay at one end of the tunnel until the person made it all the way to the other end to guard the light switch, and then the other person would start through the tunnel. If anything would happen, they could turn the lights back on. But that's how they had to move to the tunnel. And the other thing, and I'm going to test your memory real hard here, I was told, right. I wrote an article for the community hospital newspaper, and I can't recall what the newspaper's name was, but I wrote this, I'm going to say, in 2000 maybe, And it was the October edition, and it was about this ghost in University Heights. And they had gave the ghost a name. Do you recall what that was?
I do not.
I'm thinking Charlie sounds right, but that may not be it. But I know they had given the ghost a name, and I was asked to write a piece for the paper, and I did. At the time, I was working for a lady named Molly May and Jeanette Tuttle, and at the time, I turned around and wrote the paper, and it got published for the October edition, I think in 2000. It might have been 99 or 2000. It was the October edition for a Halloween special. We talked about the building then. So I just wondered, cool. So is there anything else you can think of you'd like to add to that?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I just can't think of anything else that happened.
That's perfectly fine.
You know, after a few months, I toughened up.
Well, yeah, but you made it, and you got back to the regular building, and, you know.
I ain't afraid of no ghost.
Yeah, there you go. I ain't afraid of no ghost. You know, now, when you got back to the regular building, do you remember anything about the sale or disposition, what happened to the building?
I remember that they hired another guy because I think Mike had left.
Yeah.
So Ted Powell was his name, Theodore Powell.
Okay.
He took Mike's shift, which moved me to third shift at the new building. We hired another guy to work at the old hospital, and of course, he didn't last very long.
You remember his name?
And then I do not.
And that's okay if you don't. Don't worry about it.
And then I think after that, I think they just quit having security there altogether.
Okay. And they just left it where it's at. Now, nowadays, it's owned by the Annapolis Bible College at last, that we can see still under operation. And so, Jack, I can't thank you enough. This actually gave us a lot. I know the listeners will be really interested in hearing your accounts of what you've experienced there. And, you know, again, is there anything you want to add before we cut back to the programming?
No.
Okay.
I just appreciate you.
No problem. Thank you again, Jack. We appreciate that very much. All right, folks, we're back. What did you think about Jack's interview? I mean, you know, think about that. That's pretty interesting. So as we look at things now, we're past the point that, you know, someone else has bought the building. We have the Indianapolis Bible College. And so at that point, you know, when Mike and told me about the original interview of all this, we reached out to see if I could get in there. And we talked to an employee back in August of 98, and I was told that I needed to talk with a maintenance man to make the arrangements, but they were going to let me do it. I found that very interesting because most religious societies don't want you in. So in December of that year, I was told that permission was obtained to investigate the building through although they didn't really have a date yet. They were working on a date to be set. I was told it would have to be after a semester break in June. Well, we were scheduled in June to conduct the investigation on August 13, 1999. And actually, I was just going to go in, and I told, you know, Jack I hadn't had much contact with, but I told Mike he could go in with us, and it was another gentleman that we talked about going in. So anyway, in July, I was called back before this happened and told that we were not going to be going in that building, nor was I allowed to talk to the maintenance man, nor would he take any more calls from me, period. We always figured maybe the preacher found out or something and shut it all down, but we were never allowed past that point. Over the years, a couple times I reached out to try to see if I could get in the building and was quickly told no, that they weren't going to support that kind of thing. So, but anyway, yeah, it is what it is. So before we go, I know Mia and Eric, this is your first time on the show. Any comments? Anything you want to put in?
No, I'm just honestly just glad to be here. Doing the research, I feel a connection to the hospital, even though I never personally saw it. It was really an honor to do the research.
Outstanding. You do a good job. And thank I mean, you. Jennifer told me yesterday how good a job you do. We were doing some taping before she went on vacation. Mia, you do a fantastic job on social media. Anything you want to tell any of your social media listeners that are out there?
Just follow us and stay tuned for more.
Yep. Ask questions. I mean,
if you ask questions,
if Mia sees that, you know, if she can't answer them, she'll hit one of us and let us know it's out there. you know, certainly, you know, let us know how you're liking Ghost to Ghost. I mean, things are starting to improve. We're doing some new things. We're getting ready to go with video here shortly, so stay tuned.
Yes.
That's coming down the road. So, all right. Well, now, at this point in time, we usually cite our sources. I'm going to have Eric do that since he did all the research on this.
Great. Thank you. So, our sources for today's podcast, obviously the Mike Dance interview from August of 1998, interview with Jack England of February 2024, personal experiences and notes, Facebook page, Indie Nostalgia for February of 22. And I definitely want to give a shout out to the Indie Star because that gave me a lot of background information. Although, as we said earlier, there is not as much as I would like for there to have been. So if you can help fill in the blanks, please reach out on social media.
Yeah. If you know anything, post it on Facebook. Let us know you're out there. I want to thank both me and Eric.
Or if they worked there.
Yes. If you worked there, you have a relative that worked there, anything you got, get a hold of us. We'd really love to hear you. Okay, so that's the conclusion for tonight's episode of Ghost Ghost. We hope you've enjoyed this evening's episode. This episode of Ghost Ghost was written by Chief Lawson and Eric Kerr. It is now time for our Ghost Story of the Day with Jennifer Verne.
Today's Ghost Story of the Day from the Boston Globe, November 1st, 1926. Hospital's ghost spurns Halloween. Fails to perform for Brockton watchers. Old tunnels beneath buildings may solve mystery. Brockton, October 31st, Halloween. The time of ghosts and goblins, queer noises and gibberings, passed without any manifestation from the shadowy screecher of Brockton City Hospital. For a week, the ghost has made nightly visits to the hospital, and in the wee hours of the morning, patients, nurses, and even members of the Brockton police force were startled, and in some cases frightened, to hear high-pitched, long, drawn-out screams. The screams sounded first near Ward A in the old part of the building, and then in other sections, ending in a long, drawn-out, derisive wail from the distance. But the ghost has not been indicated, or located. Apparently, it is temperamental, for on the one night of the year, a night given over to fantastic and mystical apparitions, when the ghost had a real right to perform, he did not show up from midnight to daylight. For the first time in a week since last Sunday, the hospital was free from the disturbance of the nocturnal visitor. Patients in Ward A and Wales Ward slept comfortably, but nurses, house officers, and others kept alert for hours. Shortly after 5 o'clock, when the nurses entered the wards to prepare the patients for the day, the patients seemed to be more disturbed by the absence of the ghost than when he had made his calls. Last February, the noises were first heard for about 3 weeks and were repeated again a week ago Wednesday. During the height of the heavy rainstorms last Sunday night, the patients and members of the night staff were startled by loud noises and wailing in a high-pitched tone. The tone was not too high for a man's voice, however. For several nights, the detail of police have guarded the hospital and conducted an investigation of the matter, but the officers did not lay the ghost. One patient declared that from the window of his room, he saw the ghost run away after a particularly loud screech was heard. Beneath the building, there are several old tunnels that connect various department buildings, and it is possible for someone to enter them if he were familiar with the institution. While some of the screaming and wailing seems to come from beneath the building, most of it is from outside. However, various suspects have been checked up and eliminated from the investigation. Last night, the police detail was not seen in the hospital, but a group of men and women kept vigil in Ward A. 2 ex-patients, a house physician, 4 women nurses, and a Boston reporter awaited the ghost. At 3 a.m., the patients and physicians left for bed, but the reporter's vigil continued through the night. Constantly, the nurses assured him that he was about to see a ghost, or that the ghost always appeared at a certain time. At 5:30 o'clock, the watchful end waited with no ghost.
Thanks for listening to Ghost. Again, I'm your host, Chief Lawson. You can find Ghost to Ghost on all major formats on the 15th and 30th of the month at midnight. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, maybe have a question or subject you'd like to ask about on air, or be used on the show, please email us at ghosttoghost@spiritindiana.com, ghost2ghost at spiritindiana.com. I want to thank my production staff on Spirit, Jennifer Vern, our research manager and our producer, and Heather Lawson, our trainer on Spirit and our podcast director, for helping make these podcasts possible. My chief of staff, Andrew Books, for his guidance and help on the scripts, and everyone else involved. Thank you so much. See you next time. Until then, stay safe and remember the truth is out there. Good night. Ghost to Ghost Podcast and its contents is the property of Spirit Paranormal LTD, all rights reserved. We welcome you to download and play the podcast and share with others for personal use. You may not, except with written permission, use or distribute its contents for commercial use. Spirit Indiana Paranormal, covering the Hoosier State since 2002, Indy's oldest parapsychology investigation group. If you're experiencing what you believe to be paranormal issues, reach out to us for help at www.spiritindiana.com or call our hotline at 317-883-9103. Again, that is www.spiritindiana.com or our hotline at 317-883-9103. Thank you for listening. Take care of yourself and the ones you love, and be safe out there.